Welcome to the Smichael Speaks podcast channel. I'm Joanne Smichael, and I'm delighted that you tuned in for relevant leadership learning that will help you continue to soar. Enjoy this episode. Dr. Merit Sutkovich is the chair of the Department of Neurology and the director of the Sean M. Healy and AMG Center for ALS at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also the Julianne Dorn Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School in Boston. Interestingly enough, she is leading the very first platform trial initiative in ALS. She's also the principal investigator of the Clinical Coordination Center for what's called NeuroNext. And I bet you want to know what NeuroNext stands for. It's the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Strokes Neurology Network of Excellence in Clinical Trials, NeuroNext. Welcome, 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 Merit. I appreciate you coming.
Well, thank you, Joanne. Happy to be here.
She's my featured guest as we continue our exploration of brain matters. Merit, you have a deep interest in ALS and are instrumental in leading global collaboration, not just national collaboration, on research into both cures and treatments for that disease. Will you tell me what in the world sparked your interest in this particular disorder?
When I was a resident in the 90s, the first genes that cause ALS, Alzheimer's, Huntington's, were discovered. And it was really, they were breakthroughs in the field of neurology, and people started to talk about the possibility of developing treatments for those disorders. And it was what everybody was excited about. And that I said, this is what I want to do. I want to develop treatments for these neurodegenerative disorders. And then over time, I just fell for the patients with ALS. They're really amazing, resilient people that I've learned a lot from, and it's become a lifelong passion to try to find treatments for them.
That's very interesting. You mentioned when you were in residency, so will you share a little bit about your background? What advanced training did you get to prepare you to be a leader in the world of ALS?
Well, I'm a physician scientist, so I went to medical school, and then I did a couple of years of training to become a neurologist. And back in the 90s, you could kind of make up your own fellowships. So I made up my fellowship with my mentors to learn how to do clinical trials and learn about these different neurodegenerative diseases. So I actually started seeing patients with ALS, Parkinson's, Huntington's, and I actually learned how to do trials from people in medicine and infectious disease and other diseases, because back then there weren't that many neurologists doing clinical trials. And so I learned from people from other fields. And over time, you know, one of the most important mentors for me was this guy, Ira Schulson. He just recently passed away. He was a leader in Parkinson's clinical trials, and he took me under his wing, even though he was at another institution. He was at the University of Rochester, and he taught me about how do you get people to work together? How do you build consortium? How do you develop trials and networks? And I really owe a lot of what I ended up doing to his early mentorship.
You mentioned consortiums. Will you talk a little bit about this international consortium that you co-founded to study ALS? What does the group do? When did you found it? What are your goals? What's your strategy? Will you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's called the NEALS Consortium, and stands for Northeast ALS Consortium. But it's no longer Northeast. But it started in the Northeast. And it was 1995. The first gene for ALS had been discovered in 1993. And a group of nine centers in the Northeast got together and started thinking, okay, what if we have a drug in ALS? You know, what do we need to develop it and test it? And we really needed everything. We didn't know how to measure disease, how to do trials. And so that group started to, you know, bring our lunch together and brainstorm. And eventually that group grew to what it is now, which is 150 centers all over the world that work together to try to bring treatments forward from the lab into clinical trials to people living with the disease.
Oh, how interesting. How very interesting. So it's really expanded to have global reach. And where are the labs?
They're all over really the world. Most of the centers are in North America, United States, and Canada, but we have centers in South America, the Middle East, Europe. Really, anyone who's taking care of people with ALS can join. There's no barriers to joining the network. And anyone who touches or cares about ALS from that center is part of it. So you could be a scientist, a physical therapist, a neurologist. Really, it's about bringing the whole community together to think about how to cure this illness.
You hit on something that I want to talk about. Opportunities for community involvement in studies of ALS. Are there opportunities for community involvement in the research that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, I'd say the patient voice became very loud. It should always have been loud and important, but it really came to fruition a couple of years ago, slightly after the ice bucket challenge that raised so much awareness and funds for ALS. And so now people living with ALS, their family members, they're part of our NEALS consortium. We actually have a clinical research training course for them to teach them about clinical research, and they teach us about, you know, what's important for them and what are the barriers to maybe being part of research. And we no longer design any study without the patient voice, and it actually makes it better. The trials are better, and it also makes it more fun. It really is a community that works together.
So this idea of clinical trials, will you explain what is a clinical trial? Why do they matter? And how can a person, just a lay person like me, find out about clinical trials?
Clinical trials are really important to determine if a treatment is safe and whether it works in a population. So it's a way to have people be part of research, collect data in a meaningful way that you can then look at and really say with confidence, this drug works, it's safe, this is how you have to give it. And it's really the only way and the fastest way to get treatments out there for everybody. There's a couple ways that people can be get involved. One is, you know, their physician hopefully is knowledgeable in telling them about it. But if their physician doesn't know about it, there's a website called clinicaltrials.gov where companies or researchers have to post their clinical trials there before they enroll a single person. So that's required. So you can always find it there. And then in ALS, there's some foundations that posted called one of them is called IAMALS, another one, the ALS Association. So there's a couple ways that people can find out. But I always tell people to start by asking your neurologist or your doctor. And if they don't know, ask them to point you to the right place to find it.
Okay. You know, I hear a lot of people say, I don't want to be a guinea pig. And I think that's because they equate clinical trials with random experimentation. What is the difference between a clinical trial and an experiment?
That's such a good question. In a way, you know, a clinical trial is an experiment. It's a way to determine if a drug works or not. And it is really done with a lot of oversight and a lot of safety. And so that people really should not feel like they're a guinea pig. It's taking some good science from the lab and saying, okay, I have to tell if this works or not. And what's the fastest way I can do that with the fewest number of people and the safest way to get a clean answer? But it is altruism from people to be part of trials. But it's the only way that we can get treatments for everybody.
In clinical trials, do you reach out to find a diverse group of people because a disease may impact me as a woman of color differently than it does, you know, somebody else?
Absolutely. It's so important that the studies have populations that reflect, you know, the population that you're going to treat. And that is the diversity. And that is it's hard, but it's not impossible. And there's lots of people working on how do you identify the barriers to being part of the trials, how do you lower them, and how do you make sure that at the end we know how the drug works in each of the populations.
Okay. I am also aware that you serve on the board of the American Brain Foundation. How does that organization fit into this quest for treatments and cures for ALS and other neurologic disorders?
I love the American Brain Foundation. I'll just say that. They are really instrumental in supporting young people to go into clinical research for brain disorders and to develop treatments for people living with a brain disease. The very first grant I ever received was from the American Brain Foundation and the Academy of Neurology. And not only did that give me some funds and time to learn to be a clinical trialist, it also connected me with other clinical trialists who became mentors and helped me on the path. And the American Brain Foundation has done that now for hundreds of people.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So you've advanced in your career and are a really established researcher. I'm sure, you get plenty of funding, but the early career researchers, the people that you mentor, because you're active in a lot of mentoring, who supports their research? Like, who is it that supports them when they have a novel idea that they want to test?
Yeah, it's there's many different ways that people can get support. I always advise the young people to apply widely, to look at foundations like the American Brain Foundation, the Academy of Neurology, but also disease-specific foundations, and also the government. I also tell them that it's never too early to think about philanthropy. Often, I learn from my patients that patients do want to give and support, but often they don't know that a young person might actually need a little bit of funds to help with their idea. So to learn to get comfortable with that as well.
When you are mentoring early career researchers, what advice do you give them to help them be successful?
I give them a couple of advices. One is to follow your passion. To really find what excites you, what you'll wake up in the morning excited to study and learn. Because you're going to spend a lot of time at work and you really should love it. And it's not always going to be easy, and it's easier to solve problems if you're really passionate about what you're doing. The other is to find a good team of mentors, because you don't have to invent everything yourself. There are people around there that want to help you. And sometimes you need a few, and you can look outside your area to have people that have the knowledge that can help you. And then the third is really to take care of yourself too, to not forget about the other parts of your life, your family, your friends, your hobbies, and to try to find that balance that works for you. But sometimes you have to be proactive to think about yourself as well.
That's interesting that you are approaching it from a whole person, giving advice about the whole person. I would love to ask you to come back. I want to talk about brain health, cures, and treatments because cures and treatments are possible, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to come back.
Thank you. All right, you will come back, and thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, John, for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you got tools that you'll actually use and share. Subscribe if you haven't already. I add new and relevant leadership learning all of the time. If you haven't visited the Smichel Speaks YouTube channel, check it out. There's all sorts of new content. All of this is virtual leadership learning that will help you soar.